Welcome back to the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to talk about women in combat. It's a question that is probably on the top of some minds. Combat is certainly on the top of everyone's mind on this day when we are, at least according to everyone's estimate, mere hours away from the beginning of, at the very least, an air war in Iraq. Now, there are women in the military. We'll get a little history on this in the course of our conversation. But are there women in combat? Where is the line drawn between a woman who is serving in the military and in the combat zone and a woman who is in combat, flying missions? What kind of missions are they flying in the Air Force and the Army and the Navy as such? We'll talk about that in the course of this hour of Issues Etc. with Elaine Donnelly. She's president of the Center for Military Readiness. Lots of questions. I hope she has lots of answers. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Elaine Donnelly, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, it's good to talk to you.
Elaine, before we get into kind of the what of women in combat, should women be fighting in Iraq? That's the war that faces us right now.
Well, it's good to start with good definitions. Combat, historically, has meant actually engaging the enemy. It is not the same as being in a danger zone or even a combat zone. There were only a few men who served in actual combat in Desert Storm, and there were no women in combat in Desert Storm, even though some of them were killed serving their country. The definition of combat means engaging the enemy in an assertive way. However, the rules have changed quite a lot since then, and I think the American people need to realize this. Women in the military are there to stay. They're serving their country well, but we may see some things happening that are quite disturbing under the new rules.
So let's go to the should question. If you consider it from a military standpoint, from deploying troops at their peak of efficiency, their peak of fighting ability, morale, all the things that are necessary mm-hmm. for our troops to be on the ground, should women be engaged in combat?
Well, I do have some reservations about some of the units that were opened in 1994 that previously had been male only. For example, air cavalry helicopters are scout helicopters. They fly ahead of the troops. They see where the enemy is. It's an intelligence function. But, excuse me. Excuse me, I have to get a glass of water.
Can you carry on there, Elaine? Folks, our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're talking about women in combat. Our guest is Elaine Donnelly. She's president of the Center for Military Readiness. If you have questions or comments about this, I'm sure you do. Maybe some of you even have daughters or relations, who serve in the military. Those phone numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Elaine, you were right in the middle of a thought there.
Yes, I'm back. Sorry about that. In Desert Storm, as I was saying, there were positions that women were not in, such as the air cavalry helicopters. But those positions are now open, and women are flying those combat helicopters as well as the transport helicopters that they did fly in Desert Storm. Now, the air cavalry helicopter community is at great risk of being shot down, becoming prisoners of war. And if that should happen with some of our female pilots and something occurs similar to what happened in Somalia, I believe that will be very troubling to this nation. At least I'd like to think that it would be, because that kind of violence against women at the hands of the enemy is something we've not seen before in previous wars. And I think the effect of that is somewhat unpredictable at this point.
Why were women introduced into the military, but in particular, as you mentioned, 1994 decisions, why were women introduced into these kind of fuzzy gray areas with regard to combat?
Well, because Bill Clinton was elected on the day that a presidential commission on which I served voted against the use of women in combat aviation, starting with aviation, but certainly combat ships and land combat. But on the day we voted, Bill Clinton was elected. His administration pretty much did the opposite of what we recommended. Right now, the only positions that are all male are submarines, special operations forces helicopters, and multiple launch rocket systems. And special operations also, like the Navy SEALs and so on. It's not that wide a community that are now closed to women. And certainly we're going to see some things that we have not seen before, and I'm not quite sure that all of the social engineering of the past years, the double standards in training, co-ed basic training, the consequences of all that, that may cause some problems. And I just hope that the armed forces are candid about that, that the Defense Department is candid about it, and we reassess when it's all over whether this is a good thing for the military or not.
What was the rationale of the Clinton administration in making these changes?
Well, it was an interesting era. A deputy assistant secretary of the Army at the time by the name of Sarah Lister, you may remember her, she became quite infamous when she referred to the Marines as extremist. She lost her job within 48 hours. She was forced to resign. There was such an uproar when she called the Marines extremist. However, her legacy remains. She wanted to have women in special ops helicopters, like the ones in the movie Black Hawk Down. She wanted them in the multiple launch rocket systems. She tried to force that on the Army and almost succeeded. But it, as it turned out, when the chief of staff of the Army found out, he rescinded that order that almost could have gone into effect. However, what she did get was the gender integration of the air cavalry helicopters, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, and also co-ed basic training, which has been shown to be a problem in the Army. The Training and Doctrine Command recently admitted that co-ed basic training is inefficient, but they said it's effective because the women like it better and the men behave better. Well, to me, that's not a good enough reason for a program that is known to be inefficient, something as important as basic training. And it's not a charm school. It's there to transform civilians into soldiers, and we need to do a better job. I will say this, however, the morale right now is very high because of this president. I think the troops have a very high level of trust in President George W. Bush, certainly more so than Bill Clinton, who was very much into social engineering. And I think that trust in the commander-in-chief is going to make a real difference in what's ahead.
Aside from the civilian leadership of the military, what does the military leadership within the various branches, what do they think about women in combat? What do they think about women serving in the armed forces?
Well, I can tell you they support women in the armed forces. We all do. But those who came before the presidential commission, particularly in the communities I mentioned, special operations, helicopters, field artillery, that sort of thing, infantry, they were very strongly opposed. Now, that was 1992. At that time, the commission was set up to listen to their opinions, and we listened. That's why we came out against the use of women in combat aviation. However, the whole issue was politicized when Bill Clinton came in. There were no laws left barring women from combat aviation or even combat ships. So the Clinton administration proceeded to write new rules in 1994, and now we're about to see the consequence of those rule changes.
What are your concerns regarding women serving in combat? You said that women serving the military in the general sense is here to stay. What are your concerns about the combat role for women?
Well, again, in combat, these are the units that directly engage the enemy. Yes, physical strength matters, endurance matters when you're in those types of units, more so than in support units. Personal dynamics also matter. Unit cohesion matters. Men and women together do relate to each other differently. If a man and a woman relate to each other and they exclude everyone else, then that interferes with what is called unit cohesion, and that's a problem. But the basic issue comes down to, I guess, two things. Women do not have an equal opportunity to survive in combat or to help fellow soldiers survive. And the second reason is the one that the commission actually voted against the use of women in combat aviation, and it was along this line, that if you say it's okay to have women in combat units, including helicopters that would be shot down, and if the pilot survives, is captured by the enemy and abused in predictable ways, what we're saying there is that violence against women is okay. And that was a point of view that was expressed to the commission, but it was not appreciated or not agreed to by the majority. And we realize there's really no demographic reason to send women into combat units, and it would be a step backward for civilization.
Why
to say that violence is okay as long as it happens at the hands of the enemy.
You mentioned that women don't have an equal opportunity to survive or help members of their unit survive. Why aren't they as survivable as men in combat?
Again, we're talking about combat units, mm-hmm. where it's routine to have to carry a pack of 100 pounds or more, or even 40 pounds or more, is a load that is easy for a man to carry, but certainly not for a woman. You can talk about all the Amazon myths you want, all the theories of equality, but all the science shows, and believe me, there's been multiple, multiple studies, both in the United States and Britain and elsewhere, showing that the physical differences are indeed profound and they matter in combat units. Upper body strength, a third, usually less on average. Aerobic capacity, that's important to march or to carry heavy weights long distance, is I think about 25% less. If this is something that, yes, you can have physical conditioning, you can make women stronger, but the strongest woman is still going to be only at the lowest level or an average level of men, and it just doesn't make sense to have soldiers who are less versatile, less strong, and also are vulnerable to such things as medical issues, including pregnancy. It just wouldn't make sense to assume that all soldiers are interchangeable. There's other issues, too, that trouble the nation. Does it matter who does the soldiering and who does the mothering? We're starting to see pictures even today in the New York Times. You see families being separated, sometimes both parents being deployed at the same time. It's starting to set in, not quite as much as it did in Desert Storm, but we're going to be seeing more of this, especially in the reserve ranks. You're going to have dual service couples deployed, single parents, little kids left behind. Even some kids may end up being orphans. In Desert Storm, it was feared that would happen. It really didn't happen to the degree it was feared. But I think that that could change very much in what's ahead. How is this going to affect the nation? Do we really have to do this? Or should we have primarily young men defending this country and women in support roles?
It has been said, Elaine, that the Israeli model with women in combat has proven that it can be done. It can be done successfully.
Yes,
is this true?
That's a common bit of misinformation. In Israel today, women don't go anywhere near the kinds of positions that women do. In fact, they never did, except for a few days in the War of Liberation. There was a unit that was overcome by the enemy. Women were killed. Their bodies were desecrated. It was so troubling to the nation that they never did it again. So, yes, women are in the military. Every citizen defends their country because it's surrounded by enemies in Israel. But women do not serve in close combat. They are automatically exempt if they are married or pregnant. That is certainly not the case in America's military.
You mentioned before social engineering, and this kind of broadens the question.
Yes.
To the purpose of the military and its various branches within our nation, within our society, and positioning us in the world of geopolitics. What is the purpose of the military, and why do you refer to some of these changes as social engineering?
Well, because some people have tried, and you hear this frequently with the Air Force Academy scandal, we need to change the culture of the military. We need to make it less masculinist. Some feminists claim that masculinism in the military contributes to higher rape rates, which is really not true. Rates are lower in the military than in the civilian world. But everybody needs to keep in mind, the military is there to defend the country. That is its primary, fundamental purpose. The Presidential Commission on which I served had major debates on a very simple issue. Is equal opportunity and careerism more important than defending the country, or is it not? Now, the majority voted that, yes, equal opportunity and careers are important in the military, but if there is a conflict between career considerations and the needs of the military should come first. Now, you would think that would be a non-controversial statement, but I can assure you that the advocates of women in combat really didn't care, no matter what the price was in terms of combat efficiency or any other factor. They were bound and determined to promote careerism as the primary thing. And I hasten to add that it's not the women in the military that are pushing this. It's only a few very ambitious female officers and some civilian theorists, the ones who believe in masculinism in the military as a cause of rape. These ideologues, unfortunately, had a great deal of influence in the Clinton administration, and some of them are still in the Pentagon today. But I think the majority of American people understand you don't send anybody into combat or anywhere near combat if you're going to put social issues or careerism or any other factor ahead of the needs of the military, the efficient accomplishment of the mission. Certainly women in the military as well as men have a very important interest in that.
Several years ago, and this was probably right around the time of the first Gulf War, there was a lot of news, a lot of feature news regarding life on aircraft carriers, 5,000 men and women,
yes,
packed onto an aircraft carrier, and all some of the problems that putting these predominantly young sea persons, I don't even know what to call them, all together on one boat for long tours.
Right.
Tell us about those.
Well, it was discovered shortly after the aircraft carriers were gender integrated that a number of pregnancies occurred, not just during the deployment, but prior to it, which meant that the women could not be deployed because the deployment would be 6 months at least. So this becomes a readiness issue because it doesn't matter how excellent the sailor is. If she is not there when the ship deploys, there are no replacements for her or for others who are missing during that deployment. Those numbers have been steadily climbing over the years, but now it's very difficult to find out exactly what they are. But for every sailor who's missing due to pregnancy or other medical considerations, it makes the job harder for everyone else. Now, I've heard some people say, well, yes, but men leave or they have sick leave due to problems with sports injuries and the like, broken legs. The trouble is that those kinds of injuries you can recover from and get back on the job fairly quickly, as opposed to a pregnancy, which has a long lead time, postpartum time, almost a year or more that a woman can be missing. And some figures have been skewed because people, they'll look only at the pregnancy and they don't count the time after the baby is born. Well, those kinds of figures certainly are not credible, and the captains of sailing ships know that, even though they respect the female sailors.
You mentioned before those who have decried the masculinization of the military, but I want to ask a question on the other side. Are there those who are pushing for the feminization,
yes,
of the military, and has the military to some degree been feminized?
Yes, very strongly, and you don't hear it as often in the active duty ranks because once Bill Clinton became president and the order was given, in the military you have to salute and follow orders. That's why it's such a vulnerable institution. You don't really have the choice to say no. When we asked the opinions of the active duty people in 92, that was really the last opportunity that uniform leaders had to really weigh in on these questions. Now there's a new administration. There have been some encouraging changes, but still a lot of things are in place that really ought to be reviewed and perhaps changed in the interests of the military, the best interests of the military.
In the next decade with a new administration, who knows what may happen, Elaine, but will America have women in combat?
Yes, we will. And under a new definition, certain positions that used to be closed will be open, even in support positions that were considered high risk and therefore women were not there, they're going to be assigned there now. We're going to see military police, perhaps on the streets of Iraq. We're going to see intelligence experts. We're going to see pilots going into some very dangerous places. And we pray for all of them because we know, especially for women, they don't have an equal opportunity to survive if something goes wrong. And we just hope that they are protected, that they are able to do as best they can, but we hope, too, that the mission is accomplished and that we don't lose lives unnecessarily.
I'm thinking about the big historic picture. This is one of my hobbies, is studying of ancient warfare, but the big historic picture. What was the wisdom, beyond just the kind of typical charge of masculinization,
mm-hmm,
that kept women out of the military for centuries and centuries and centuries of human organized combat?
Well, I think there was a cultural value which said that good men protect and defend women. Now, feminists look on that as kind of a sexist, old-fashioned attitude, but I think it's a valuable one, and we get rid of it at great risk. Because if we say, no, women, good men, don't have to defend and protect women, what we're saying is, again, that violence against women is okay. And that's something that we have not really embraced in this country before. The effects of it, the full effects, are going to be seen in what happens next in Iraq.
What roles should women occupy in the military?
Well, I think they do a good job in the support positions, certainly medical and logistics and support and all of that, and even on ships they do a pretty good job, but we need to do a couple of things. We need to get rid of gender quotas for one thing, because gender quotas put downward pressure on standards, and it causes a lot of standards to be lowered in a way that is counterproductive to the interests of the military. So that's one thing we could do. We also need to reinstate gender-separate training, as we have in the Marine Corps, because in the Marines you have better concentration, women do better, they're challenged, but they don't have to compete against the men, and we need to get rid of that. We also need more sensible personnel policies and kind of get away from this notion that men and women are interchangeable in all positions. That's just not the case. But it all starts with an accurate and honest analysis of what happens. And yes, we're going to be proud of our women when they come marching home, but we also need to take a very clear look at what happened, what worked, what didn't work, and then make changes accordingly.
Elaine, final question. This is not on Women in Combat, but on our present situation. Are our troops ready for Iraq?
I think they are. I was concerned right after 9/11. There was a lot of catching up to do after steady deterioration in the Clinton years. Doing more with less certainly did take its toll. And we haven't really increased the defense budget as much as I think we should. But what's making the difference now is morale and trust in this commander-in-chief. That doesn't mean that everything is perfect. There still are shortages. There's concerns about the efficacy of, for instance, the biochemical protection gear. But they've been working on it. They've been working on it very hard. And people are just working their hearts out. I've heard lots of stories of people re-upping, staying in the military. Recruiting numbers are up. But we have a long ways to go, and we will need a larger force. The president needs to ask for more volunteers when he wants to, when the need is there. And then he needs to go to Congress and ask for the money to pay for them. The volunteer force is the best in the world. We need to support it. We don't need a draft, but we will have to make greater sacrifices as a nation to support those people who are out there as we speak defending this country.
Elaine Donnelly, thank you so much for being our guest and giving us your time here on Issues Etc.
You're very welcome.
Elaine Donnelly is president of the Center for Military Readiness. We've been talking about women in combat. You can check out the website for the Center for Military Readiness at cmrlink.org. That's cmrlink.org. Or you can call the Center for Military Readiness at area code 202-347-5333. That's area code 202-347-5333. There is an impulse, I believe, and I'm going solely upon not only the lessons of history, but I think also personal experience here. There is an impulse in the man to protect, to defend, to, if necessary, to fight. There's that impulse. Women may share that impulse to a great degree, but in a different context, I think. To protect, yes, to defend, yes, perhaps when necessary, to fight. But our military might do well, rather than asking the question, what can women do in the military, ask the question and answer it, what should women do in the military? We'll have calls after this.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The courts of justice are there to protect our rights and to right the wrongs that occur between men. Should Christians take one another to court? What's the difference between conflict resolution and Christian reconciliation? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March is called Confession and Forgiveness by Ted Kober. You can order the book online by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Under the What's New section, you'll find information on the book, and you can even read an excerpt. issuesetc.org, or order by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours at 1-800-325-3040. Now, when you call, be sure to ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, Confession and Forgiveness, 1-800-325-3040, weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer.
A Senate committee is looking into the problem of illegal internet gambling. Lawmakers are working on a bill that would cut off the money supply. With the NCAA basketball tournament about to begin, a lot of people are thinking about sports and betting. David Brody reports from Capitol Hill.
The Senate knows something needs to be done about gambling on the internet. It's a cancer spinning out of control. Frank Fahrenkopf heads the American Gaming Association.
Internet gambling provides the forum, the means, the vehicle. It's the Wild West of gambling because of its anonymity and access.
During the hearing, it was made very clear that young kids are getting hooked. And then there are the college athletes who are getting involved as well. The latest figures show that 5% of them are betting on college games. William Somm is with the National Collegiate Athletic Association.
Young people, especially athletes, have characteristics that put them at risk, such as being risk takers, being very aggressive individuals. Great characteristics of great athletes, but when they go to the wrong side, it puts them at risk for gambling issues.
Compounding the problem is not only the ease of logging on and playing, but also the fact that many are being duped into believing that it's legal. John Malcolm is with the U.S. Attorney General's office.
The sheer volume of advertisements for offshore sportsbook and online casinos is troubling because it misleads the public in the United States to believe that such gambling is legal when in fact it is not.
All the panelists agree that the best way to crack down on the problem is to stop the money supply, and the way to do that is to not allow those businesses to accept credit cards over the internet. The Senate bill would do that. For Family News and Focus, I'm David Brody in Washington.
The Justice Department has some reservations about the bill's criminal provisions, but it's believed that those can be worked out. The House has an identical bill, but it is not final yet. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Are you experiencing turmoil or trouble in your life? What does Romans 8:28 mean to you? And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. We'll discuss this verse and chapter 8 next time on the Bible Study with Pastor Ed Wolf. The Bible Study is heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
The 20th annual Kappa Delta Shamrock event to benefit the local Southside Day Nursery and Prevent Child Abuse America will be March 22nd at Webster Hills United Methodist Church. It begins at 7 p.m. in the Christian Education Center, 698 West Lockwood at Berry Road in Webster Groves. The event is part of Kappa Delta's National Shamrock Event fundraising effort, in which collegiate and alumni members have raised more than $5 million since 1983. For more information, contact the Alumni Association of Kappa Delta Sorority.
Welcome back. 25 minutes of open lines here to round off this hour. Then we'll be talking with Pastor David Peterson of Redeemer Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about beauty. What is beauty beyond just what we can see? We'll talk about that in the last hour of Issues, etc. Open lines for anything you want to talk about. What do you think about women in combat? We just finished our conversation with Elaine Donnelly from the Center for Military Readiness. And I know that the arguments that have been put forth, well, the military needs to get in step with society and become as egalitarian as society. Does that lead necessarily, even if you hold those views, does that lead necessarily to putting women in combat? Give me a call. The phone numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Perhaps you have a female relative or child, grandchild, that serves in the military. Maybe you have some thoughts on this. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. First-time callers, car phone callers, and internet callers get top priority. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the Space Shuttle Columbia tragedy. Astronaut Sandra Magnus joins us for that conversation. We'll also talk about pietism. What in the world is pietism? It sounds good. Piety? That sounds nice. Pious? That seems to be a good thing. What was pietism? This movement that put so much emphasis on what's going on in one's heart and head and necessarily detracted emphasis from what God has done in Christ? We'll talk about it with Professor Larry Rast tomorrow on Issues, etc. It's open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I had the opportunity to actually sit down with a real live newspaper this morning. Normally, I read all my newspapers online, but I went to the dentist office this morning, and while waiting, I had the opportunity to read the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. What I saw there was a rebuttal to an op-ed piece that appeared over the weekend on the issue of abortion, and it made me kind of go back through my mental files and remember, hey, I think I read that op-ed piece. This is what I'm talking about. You may have read it yourself, called Undermining Choice, from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, I think it was Saturday. Those who support abortion rights and have taken them for granted are getting a rude wake-up call from Congress and from the Missouri legislature. The U.S. Senate has passed a partial birth abortion bill that ignores the health of women. Meanwhile, the GOP majority in the legislature is pushing a series of onerous restrictions, making it even harder for a woman to obtain an abortion or even information about her options. Now, of course, they're talking about the U.S. Senate total ban on partial birth abortion that passed, and they're also talking about movement within the Missouri House that would, well, first of all, that would require parents to be informed and level civil penalties at those who take, not women, it says women in the op-ed piece, but not women, girls, underaged children, out of state to have an abortion in Illinois. Now, I find it interesting here that it talks about restricting a woman's right to obtain an abortion, when in fact that law has nothing to do with a woman's right. It has everything to do with the parents' rights, and it has to do not with women, but with girls. But the op-ed piece goes on. It says, it's a grim day when the U.S. Senate votes 64-33 in favor of a bill that fails to acknowledge the health of women and the dictates of the Constitution, speaking, of course, of the fact that there was a health provision that was an attempted amendment to this bill that would have created in the bill a hole so big you could drive a tanker through it. Because, of course, the health exception can be construed to embrace just about any circumstance. Now, I want you to think about this, in particular with the partial birth abortion ban. If a woman is able to carry a child to the point where the child actually can be born, and in the process of being born can be aborted, then what possible health consideration could there be for this woman? The very procedure itself requires that she be able to give birth to the child. The child's birth poses no risk to her. If it did, they wouldn't be doing a partial birth abortion. The only reason for imposing and reading into it a health provision is to make the ban on partial birth abortion no ban on partial birth abortion. The op-ed piece goes on to praise Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin for trying his darndest to get this health provision in. He was not able to do so to the tune of 60-38 in the U.S. Senate. And then it says, not only is a health exception a constitutional requirement, but it also is required by human decency. Strictly speaking, it's not a constitutional requirement. It is a requirement according to the Roe Court's interpretation of the Constitution. There's a difference there. In other words, I'm saying, with regard to whether or not the Constitution has this requirement in it, the jury's still out. The Senate debate was filled with misinformation and misconceptions, and then the op-ed piece goes on to litter about its own trash of misinformation and misconceptions. Now, the response comes from Raymond Skubick of Florissant. I thought it was a telling response. I'd like to read the entire response to you. Legislation would protect the unborn is the title. It was in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. The March 16th editorial, Undermining Choice, was terribly inaccurate. What the U.S. Senate passes is a bill recognizing the moral atrocity of partial birth abortion. It is a bill to protect the life of some, although not all, of the unborn. Rather than being grim, as the editorial states, the nearly 67% vote of the Senate reflects that the will of an ever larger majority of people as the viability of the unborn becomes more obvious. It is specifically the health of the unborn that the bill is intended to protect, which is perfectly in line with the Constitution, a fact ignored in the editorial. As for the debate in the Senate, there was no misinformation and there were no misconceptions. Factual data were presented on both sides of the argument. But you see, I pause here for a moment just to inject something. If you, the way that this is viewed by pro-choicers is if you present an argument against any form of abortion, if you present an argument against unrestricted abortion from conception until natural birth, you are presenting misinformation on the face of it. That's their viewpoint. The fact that the St. Louis Post-Dispatch disagrees with the data and their impact does not render them incorrect. In fact, in view of the paper's biased record on this topic, its disagreement with any data would enhance the data's credibility in the eyes of most. The term partial birth abortion is anything but vague. It's very descriptive, isn't it? It describes in three hyphenated words, exactly what takes place. In fact, because it is this accurate of a description, it is a term that is commonly used by lawyers, members of Congress, the public, and those in the medical profession. As for misinformation or lack of information, the bill passed last week in the Missouri House is designed specifically to prevent that. It would provide a 24-hour waiting period to digest information as to the risks of abortion. And there we bring up another bill that I didn't mention before, having to do with a mandatory 24-hour waiting period. For what purpose? For the purpose of a woman not only receiving, but also being able to digest information about the procedure she is seeking. In spite of the recent editorials to the contrary that include significant data supporting a link to breast cancer, while research of that subject is not definitive, to suggest that the results to date should be ignored to suit your ideology is disingenuous at best. The final misguided charge of state coercion to restrict freedom is equally off the mark, since the intent of all legislation is to protect the freedom of life, not to end life. That's a response to that op-ed piece, Undermining Choice. It appeared in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch today. It's open lines. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Here's an interesting story from Religion News Service. Vatican says Bush will answer to God on Iraq war. This is the latest from the Vatican in response to the president's speech given two nights ago. Vatican spokesman said Bush, quote, assumes a grave responsibility before God, his conscience, and before history. The Vatican said Tuesday that President Bush will have to answer to God for his decision to invade Iraq and oust Saddam Hussein. Vatican spokesman Joaquin Navarro-Valls rejected Bush's 48-hour ultimatum and chastised Bush for dropping diplomacy at the United Nations and ignoring American allies who oppose the war. Whoever decides that all peaceful means under international law have been exhausted is assuming a grave responsibility before God, his conscience, and before history, Navarro-Valls said in a terse statement. Meanwhile, Catholic officials in Washington announced that they would celebrate a Mass for Peace on Tuesday and Wednesday, while some of the church's top leaders are in the nation's capital. Pope John Paul II, who dispatched envoys to meet with both Bush and Saddam, has vowed to keep his embassy in Baghdad open despite the war. Speaking to pilgrims in St. Peter's Square on Sunday, the Pope again voiced his opposition to the war and asked the world to, quote, do everything possible to avoid killing. I belong to that generation that lived through the Second World War and survived, he said in an impromptu remark following his prepared statement. I have the duty to say to all young people, to those younger than I am, who have not had this experience, never again war. As Pope Paul VI said in his first visit to the United Nations. Now, what do you think of President Bush's disagreement with Pope John Paul II? Do you think that this disagreement has any influence with Roman Catholic voters? The Pope opposes the war. And one of the big questions that was facing us during the presidential election, if you remember, was where will Roman Catholic voters go because they do tend to split on issues like life. And we were all wondering, what influence did life have to do in the electing of this president? Well, on the issue of the war, where the official position of the Pope himself is against it, do you think that has any influence with Roman Catholic voters in this country? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Especially for you, our Roman Catholic listeners, those who are admittedly in line with the Pope in so many ways, what do you think about the Pope's disagreement with the president, a public disagreement with the president, and the latest statement from the Vatican spokesman saying that the president will simply have to answer God, his conscience, and history for this decision? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. For the Roman Catholic listeners and for all of you, has President George W. Bush's statement as of several nights ago, has it changed your mind? Everyone's telling us that everyone's on the fence. Has it changed your mind? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Do you feel like you're going against your church if you support the war, or do you care? Down in Texas, just last week we were talking about this imam that prayed in the Washington State House. Well, down in Texas, for the first time, an imam prayed at the Texas State House. He was invited there by Islamic Texans. No, it's not. It's not a contradiction in terms. As America moved closer to war, a Muslim cleric for the first time gave an opening prayer at a session of the Texas House of Representatives on Tuesday. Now, according to the story here from the Dallas Morning News, no one walked out. Up in Washington State, there were two that walked out. One eventually walked back in. His prayer at the microphone in front of the speaker's platform actually echoed, according to the story, he not only quoted lines from the Quran, but he also, in his prayer, echoed the Lord's Prayer. He said these words, "Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us all from the evil one." Now, that's not just an echo of the Lord's Prayer. He was quoting the Lord's Prayer there, a Muslim imam. He prayed, "Make this city and our whole nation of America a place of hope, peace, and security, because you are, O Lord, the source of peace." And as I said, at least according to the story here, no one in the Texas House of Representatives saw fit to leave the floor during his prayer. I'd like to hear from our Roman Catholic listeners who voted for George W. Bush. Do you regret having voted for Bush in light of the fact that he is now pursuing war with Iraq, and the Pope has said on several occasions that this war is wrong, immoral, unjust, and most recently that the president will have to answer to God, his conscience, and history for what he has decided to do? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Beth is calling from her car. Beth, welcome to Issues Etc.
I think that as a Christian, we need to realize that Saddam Hussein is like Hitler was, and, you know, killing thousands, and to stand by like the church did at that time and do nothing is wrong. I mean, there are other issues as far as his involvement in funding the terrorists who did attack our country. But the biggest thing that makes my mind at peace is that he is like Hitler, and we need to stop him.
Now,
and rescue those people.
Now, I do want to clarify one thing, and that is that the church stood by and did nothing with Hitler.
Oh, okay, well, I wouldn't say nothing, but there... But there were, you know, they felt their hands were tied to stop him, and we don't want to do the same.
So regarding your thoughts on the war, does it hold any sway with you that you get someone? I don't know if you're Roman Catholic or not, but does it hold any sway with you that someone like the Pope himself would say in many and various ways to the president, "Don't do this," and when he has decided to do it, say, "Well, he will answer to God for it"?
I don't think that the dear Pope is realizing that this is defending life. And that says it all.
Beth, thank you very much for the call. Now, the Pope says, given his perspective of having survived war, never again war. He doesn't want to see life taken. It is a good question that Beth raises, though, and for the Pope. And that is, what about the lives of those who will die if Saddam Hussein stays in power? Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I am curious about this, though, because of all the big news today, beyond the fact of the countdown to war, all the big news today is 70% of the American people support the president in his actions with regard to Iraq. Now, if you break down the numbers, you see that the support, about one-third of those people are still, by their own admission, not strong in their support. They're soft in their support. But this was a case in which, unlike, I think, the first Gulf War that came on us so suddenly that we were simply ready to go, had a different set of circumstances that led up to it. This was a case in America where people said, I'm not sure. And people were still willing to say, I'm not sure, up until the president spoke a couple nights ago. Still saying, I'm not sure. And I was driving in today listening to these various poll numbers, thinking to myself, I wonder whether or not the first shot being fired will get people off the fence so that they are sure. Or whether the doubts that plagued them, maybe you're a Roman Catholic and you've been plagued by the same kind of doubts that the Pope has raised, will continue to plague them even after we're on the ground and doing what we have to do. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I've said this before, that when it's all said and done, we brought the troops home and it's been successful and history has been written that this was a success, that will be the wrong time for people to say, oh, now I support it, or now I'm for it. That doesn't mean much after the fact. Well, in Salt Lake City, the prosecutors have finally gotten around to charging self-proclaimed prophet Brian Mitchell and his wife, if she is his wife. He thought that Elizabeth Smart was his wife, Wanda Barzi, with aggravated kidnapping and sexual assault in the abduction of Elizabeth Smart, disclosing for the first time the details of the girl's nine-month ordeal. Prosecutors contend that Mitchell, a drifter whose writings promote polygamy, entered the Smart home June 5th using a knife to cut the window screen. Elizabeth, dressed in pajamas, was then forced at knife point to walk 4 miles up a mountain trail behind the Smart family home to a concealed campsite, according to court papers. Then, without going into the gruesome details, there was a sexual assault. And then they held her against her will at that campsite until October the 8th, with little or no shelter, water, or food, prosecutors said. They took her to California, where they stayed until March 5th. Then she was found, Elizabeth was found, with the couple on the 12th of March in Sandy, a Salt Lake City suburb. Attorney Larry Long, who initially represented Mitchell, said that Mitchell told him he considers Elizabeth his wife, and that her disappearance was a call from God, not kidnapping. Now, family members are repeatedly contending that Elizabeth was brainwashed and that her loss of free will prevented her from escaping despite several opportunities to do so. Just an update there that they finally have charged them and they're disclosing some of the facts in the case. Facts that we probably could have surmised by simply guessing what was going on. But Mitchell says, Elizabeth was my wife. I would bet dollars to donuts the man is some form of Mormon. Or maybe this is the drifter's code. You just pick up wives as you find them. Doug is calling from his car. Doug, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, wherever it is.
Afternoon where I'm at, Doug.
All righty. I was just curious. The Archdiocese and the Pope slamming George Bush because of his beliefs, and these are the same Archdiocese people who wanted to sweep under the rug the molestation of children in the own Archdiocese. I don't understand where they can judge someone else when in the Bible it says, judge ye not lest ye be judged. And to me, the Pope's judging George Bush Saddam Hussein is killing his own people, genocide. we can't stand by and let genocide happen, can we?
Well, now, Doug, not directly to your point, but picking up on something you said, aren't you judging the Pope and the Archdiocese?
I'm not judging him in general. I'm judging his actions and his words.
Well,
I'm not judging him. I'm judging what he's saying about the president.
Well, I think that's what the Pope is doing with regard to George W. Bush, is he's judging the president's actions and what he's been saying. I don't think the Pope is saying, I have looked into my Pope's crystal ball and found a way to judge your heart. He says, I'm judging your decisions, your official actions. Another misuse of judge not lest you be judged. Now, Doug would suppose, or would assert in his question there, that the Roman Catholic Church now has no moral authority to speak on any issue, in which case we should also disregard their pro-life views. Sad to say, a lot of evangelicals do. They think they're the only pro-lifers out there, when the bulwark, the Hoover Dam of the pro-life movement, is the Roman Catholic Church, holding back the floodwaters. Then the rest of us are scurrying around like the villagers at its foot, saying, we're holding back the floodwaters. I tell you, folks, and I think that a pastor once told me this. He said, if the Roman Catholic Church ever bent on that issue or on issues like the ordination of women, he doesn't know whether American Protestantism could stand up, whether it would just be swept away entirely. But just because in some dioceses, and certainly not at the Vatican, I don't think, just because there were some bishops who swept the issues of priestly sexual abuse under the rug for years and allowed that atrocity to continue, just because that was happened, does that mean that the Roman Catholic Church now locks all moral authority, cannot speak with moral authority, even on issues like war, or, as I said, the pro-life movement? No. When they're right, they're right. When they're wrong, they're wrong. I mean, it's the way it is with all of us. It's the way it is with presidents and popes and each of us. Let me just put it to you this way, folks, and then we're going to go get to a different subject. Just because someone is wrong in one area doesn't make them wrong in every area. If we are lovers of the truth, as Christians claim to be, then regardless of what party, religion, papacy, no matter what it is, where we find truth, we ought to affirm it. Where we find falsehood, even if it's in our own backyard or in our own selves, we ought to condemn it. Because the truth is the truth, no matter who speaks it. We'll be right back. Talk with Pastor David Peterson about beauty.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.